Welcome to Eyes and Lows, the podcast where we shine a light on mental health in the blind, low vision, and disability community, bringing in experts, real stories, valuable insight, meaningful conversation, and everything in between. Join us as we explore more deeply and freely the eyes and lows of a wide range of abilities, navigating life after diagnosis, and building resilience. I am your host, Brittany McLemore, the Executive Director with Georgia Radio Reading Service. Today we have with us Keith Bailey.
Hello.
Hi, Keith.
Hi.
Why don't you start off by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Let's see. I am 30 years old. I have been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, as it's currently written, formerly Asperger's syndrome. And I can't remember if it's bipolar 1 or 2, whichever is the one without psychotic tendencies, and ADHD. I lived in Georgia practically my entire life, as far as I can remember.
Okay, well, great. We are excited to have you here today. As you know, this show is called Eyes and Lows. So why don't we start off by you letting us know what your high of this year so far has been, and maybe a low.
If we go back at least for a year to this point, mm-hmm. I visited my biological family twice throughout the year over in California, sometime in early April, and then shortly after my birthday last year.
Okay.
That was definitely a high point.
What was high about it?
Well, the fact that that was my second and third time in my memory that I can remember actually going to go visit them and see them. Because I was adopted, I have had no contact with my biological family. And little bit of a small story here. A couple years ago, I think it was 2018, I was talking to my biological grandmother, and my dad happened to be there at the time. And that was the first time I've ever talked to him. Nothing negative about it. It's just like he's just been there ever since he left Georgia. So there was no real contact with anybody on that front. I've had contact with my foster parents. I've seen them a lot, and I still regularly see them at least a couple times a year. I try to make it once a month, but sometimes it's spaced out. But I was talking to my grandmother, and he was there one day, and we just hit it off from there. A couple years later, the start of COVID, on my birthday, I flew out Halloween 2020, stayed for a week, and I got to visit and meet them all for the first time, officially, because I wasn't a baby, so I can remember it.
Right. Wow. That's fantastic. If you don't mind sharing, when were you adopted?
2001, June or July 6th or 9th. It's one of the four.
Okay. And you know both of your biological parents?
Just my father. I know the name of my biological mother, but I don't know anything about where she's at, if she's still in Georgia, if she's anywhere else.
Okay. I'm sure this is a sensitive topic, so, you know, feel free to let me know if you don't want to.
It's more whenever I try to think about my mom, because I would have to use a resource called the Georgia Adoption Reunion Registry. I keep putting it off, but I do need to do that because my dad's side, I'm with them already. So I don't need them. I don't need to find them or know where they're at, or I can contact all of them. So I would have to use that reunion registry to try to find my mom.
Okay. Were you placed in foster care from birth?
I was about 18 months old, something like that. I don't know too much about what my biological family, what my foster family, and what my adoptive family have said. Seems to be, I can't remember too much about that, but I just know that we were supposed to be in foster care for only a couple days, not about 4 or 5 years. And I was like 6, about to turn 7, something like that. That's because it was about 4 or 5 months before my birthday when we got adopted in 2001.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So you mentioned that you were diagnosed with autism, bipolar disorder as well. When were you diagnosed?
Bipolar sometime after 6, but before 8, because I've been with Advantage, which is a Northeastern regional mental health organization. And the autism, I was around 12 or 13. I was at a couple times that year in 2007. I was involuntarily hospitalized at a place called Laurelwood on about 3 or 4 separate occasions. And I can't remember if it was the first or the second time I was there, they formally diagnosed me with autism.
Okay. So what was the situation, I guess, when you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder?
I can't remember.
You can't remember. Okay. So what, if you can share, receiving these diagnoses, what did that do for your mental health or your emotional health?
I don't really know, because I never made it a part of my identity. I knew that different diagnoses existed. I didn't even know autism existed until that point. I knew about ADHD because I was just always being thrown around, and a bipolar, that I know it definitely caused a lot of problems.
Yeah.
It caused a lot of problems.
Yeah. In school, at home?
Both.
Okay. So since diagnosis, what has been your experience with services related to your diagnosis?
Well, since it was originally just the bipolar and ADHD, I've been with Advantage for a very long time and still with them for at least medication services right now. But I've been with them for counseling, the psychiatric medication stuff. Can't remember that much else overall, but I remember going to other therapists and specialists throughout the years. There was someone here in Atlanta, I can't remember them. My adoptive mom would probably remember having a weird, and it was weird to me. There was a test where they were monitoring brain waves, and they had to put the things on my head with gel and stuff. It was weird. I did that a lot.
Wow. So as an adult now, how do you believe the services available to you have helped, or has it helped?
Well, I wish there were more services for people with autism as adults here in Georgia. Because in my case, I'm high functioning. There's not that much more that can be done with what I've already learned and done with the things like the peer support group I was in with Advantage for quite a few years. And then just the other psychiatric help from growing up. There's not much more that can be added to that for how to manage, at least in my case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, just from my experience, my nephew has autism. And, you know, as we know, the spectrum is really wide. So can you share, in terms of your experience with being diagnosed with autism, how it affected your social life, you know, professional life, or any of those areas?
More things made sense.
Okay.
That's the best way to put it. More things made sense.
Okay. Tell me how.
So early on, prior to adoption with my foster parents, I never called my foster parents mom and dad, typically, from a young age, especially as young as I was. Usually you still call them mom and dad, even if you're not adopted or whatever, or at least up to a certain point. I always called them just by their names, Janet and David. And so whenever I was mad or sad or crying or whatever, I would always call for my Janet. And DFACS didn't take that like I loved them. So that's when I look back on that, it's makes me question a lot of things because of how autism is. And since certain things don't show up until later in my case, but certain things just like that makes more sense when I look back on it, because that's just something like for most people with autism, one of the easy tells, at least for the ones who, and at least in my case, the social stuff practically non-existent for a very long time. reading emotions, sarcasm. That one was fun. Me misreading sarcasm or using it wrong, causing problems with it.
Do you believe that you've learned a little more in way of social cues?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How's your social life now?
Non-existent.
It's still non-existent. Okay.
Pretty much. I try to keep it relatively low. Most of the people I talk to is online.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a lot of face-to-face, which helps.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do you find community, you know, in a space where you are navigating through your mental health? How do you find that space to maybe have someone to talk with about that or those experiences, or to help you during that time?
I don't remember just talking about it. I've had a therapist for a while early on, later on, sometime after 15, but before 18. We've talked about stuff, but it was never about mental illnesses and stuff like that. It was more just like checking in on me kind of thing, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And even at the peer support group, like, I can't remember. There's a lot I don't remember. My memory has been getting worse lately. I can remember certain things really clearly, and then others, even if it's like short term, it's still really bad.
Okay. In terms of autism or even bipolar disorder, what are some pet peeves that you might have about the stereotypes related to being diagnosed with these things?
I'd say in a sad way, I lived up to the bad side of bipolar, the extreme mood swings, for a very long time. At least in my case, luckily, I've never had too many actual depressive episodes. It's almost exclusively mania, the high side. So I'm not on like straight antidepressants. It's more mood stabilizers and things like that. And so it's mostly trying to keep things tempered down, because when I was younger, I acted out a lot. Mm-hmm. Some of it was due to my misunderstandings, mm-hmm. or because I like schedules, or in a, like, either I set it, or if it's a schedule that I like, I don't deviate from it.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused a lot of problems in different places I was at.
Okay.
Whether it was at school, home, other places I've been. Mm-hmm. There's been both good and bad about that. I've never liked being forced to do something that I didn't want to do. That caused a lot of problems.
Yeah. So how do you cope? What are some coping skills that you've found that works for you?
When I'm out in public, at least, it's the ones that aren't visible. It's listening to music mostly, just keep myself distracted if I'm at a spot where I need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, it's mostly, this is a bad one, chewing on the inside of my lip. That's a really bad one. Sometimes due to boredom, most of it's just not used to something.
Yeah.
Chewing my fingernails.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like with that behavior? Growing up and, your life in school.
School was definitely rough. I did not get along with most of the other students. I got along well with a handful of teachers.
Okay.
There's a place in Athens called Rutland. I've heard it be called an alternative school, but it's basically kids who have more behavioral problems are usually there than kids with just straight mental illnesses. It's more equipped to deal with the outbursts than actually dealing with people who are having, who are being symptomatic.
Yeah.
And so that itself caused some problems in terms of how I did not like to be told certain things I didn't want to do.
Yeah. So what do you do for fun?
Video games, ride my motorcycle.
Okay. T- Tell us about that bike.
Currently, it's a Suzuki C50T. It's a Boulevard, and it's a cruiser. Just recently got that early December, something like that. Yeah, early December. Before that, it was a 2004 Yamaha FZ6, and that was a sport bike. Before that, it was a 150cc scooter, and then it goes back to where I started with a moped. Just kind of a pretty big step increase in power with each one. Moped's 50cc's, scooter's 150, the first motorcycle was 600, and this one's an 805.
How'd you get into the bikes?
I've always liked them. Come to find out later, after connecting with my family, it kind of runs in the family. My dad, my uncle, my aunt. I don't know if my grandma rode, or her, or my grandpa, but I know that motorcycling runs. My brother rides motorcycles.
Mm-hmm.
A motorcycle. It's a Honda Grom, tiny little thing.
Has reuniting with your family been helpful for you in way of, you know, maybe even just adding to your coping skills, being able to talk to them about things? And also, have they been supportive?
Yeah. Yes, on both. Also come to find out that autism and autism tendencies run in the family.
Oh.
My second cousin, he is 4 or 5, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he is very clearly autistic. His social cues are really, really bad.
Okay. How did finding that out make you feel?
Didn't really make me feel anything specific, but my cousin, who's his mom, I told her I don't think she really needs any advice or anything because she's doing all the stuff over in California with him. I am there for her if she ever needs to, because since I have autism, and at least in my case, certain things I can at least give her a forewarning to help her be prepared for, just in case.
So what would be, let's just say, two pieces of advice that you would give to a parent raising a child with autism, and two pieces of advice that you would give a child dealing with their autism?
For adults, for one, be patient. Okay. Because not all things when it comes to early autism will make sense to you, the parent.
Mm-hmm.
It will show up as other things. Like in my case, it was with ADHD for the longest time.
Mm.
And that didn't explain everything.
Right.
And so try to obviously learn more about how the different age groups early on typically behave and how they are not necessarily symptomatic. I'm trying to think of the word for it, but like how
they present.
Yeah. How they present, the behaviors, all that stuff. Like a lot of things. It's patience, because like in my case, extremely disruptive. If I didn't like something, I wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Physical damage, sadly,
yeah,
caused a lot of that. But it's mostly patience. You don't have to. Well, I mean, you probably should throw them in timeout, but not like, because that's something that I know in personal experience, timeout doesn't work for me. It didn't work for me.
Okay.
So find different avenues. If they're misbehaving, see if they'll do something with their hands. Like in my case, I'm mechanically inclined. I like working with my hands. I was outside doing stuff half the time. If I wasn't on my consoles and stuff, I was usually doing something with my hands. So let's find out what your kid likes to do, or try to gear them to figuring out certain things they can do when they're starting to get upset, or if they are, see if you can get them to gravitate towards something. If they like using their hands, see if they want to, although I don't know how often you could do that nowadays, but like go outside, dig some with either like a little, can't remember what the little mini shovel's called for gardening, but something like that. Certain things that are physical. Get them something to take apart, like their own thing to take apart, so they won't do it to something else.
Right.
Because I've done that. Just something that will get them to stop thinking about something.
Yeah.
Okay. That and patience.
And what about some advice that you'd give your second cousin or your younger self?
Similar thing. Have patience with yourself. Because you will understand what's going on until a lot later in life. A lot of things that the adults, the teachers, a lot of things won't make sense. And the rules are there for a reason. Some, not a lot of rules can be bent. There has to be some flexibility, but it won't always work either. Try to find something that you can do to keep yourself busy. Sometimes just getting yourself preoccupied with something can distract you enough to get back to relatively normal.
Yeah. I guess that's the same advice that you can kind of give anyone that you come in contact with.
Universal, pretty much. Yeah. But it matters more, at least for me personally speaking, for those with mental illnesses. If there are certain things like with the bipolar, acting out and things like that, anything that deals with anything sensory, distracting yourself is usually one of the quickest ways to deal with your current state. If you can't do that, then it's usually a waiting game.
So what are some goals and dreams that you currently have?
Continue to reconnect with my family. Be more of an advocate for, or try to be an advocate for, younger people with autism. There's not much I can do in the bipolar space. It's more the autism at this point when it comes to trying to spread awareness from my own personal experiences. It's weird to say luckily with this, but because my autism is high functioning, certain things are relatively easier for me to grasp.
Okay.
And when I look back on certain things, it makes sense originally after the diagnosis. So I can give advice to an extent.
Okay.
And give certain warnings.
Yeah.
On certain things you might expect.
Okay.
Depending on, you could tell how certain kids will act out usually. If they're not having their way, they don't like something. And with autism, it's kind of the same thing, but more extreme. There's like, there's no full stop. It's either go or stop. It's just that there's no in between. It'll go from 0 to 100 in an instant. And so sometimes you could be in the middle of eating at a place, and then like they see something they don't like, it's just immediate tantrum or something like that. That makes no sense.
Yeah.
Why they would be acting like that. I don't know if I'm going to remember this correctly, but I remember being at the table for like 3 hours because I didn't want to eat some squash. I love squash now, but
squash is really good.
I remember being at the table for what seemed like forever because I was a kid. Any time beyond 10 minutes is forever.
Right.
But I remember not eating that squash. I can't remember what I did with it, but like I was just at that table for a long time.
Did you have difficulty with textures?
Yes.
Okay.
This is going to be really weird, and I love it now too. Okra.
Ah.
Even when it's raw, it's still slimy on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And no, almost no matter how you cook it, you could bake it, and it'll still be kind of slimy on the inside.
Okay.
That's a texture that most people are weirded out about.
Mm-hmm.
But I love it. That's an example of like trying to get someone to eat something new.
Uh-huh.
Okra is not something you give early on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because okay. of that. Textures are really important when it comes to food.
Right. So in this phase of advocacy, what does that look like for you if you could choose the way that you would do it?
I wish there, like I was saying earlier, I wish that there were more services for adults, or because there's plenty of them for kids, mm-hmm. especially here in Georgia. But like, if there are more ways for us to, like with the peer support group I was in, a way for adults with autism mm-hmm. to talk with kids with autism to give them a safer for work version of their personal histories. So things will make more sense to them because, like I said earlier, a lot of things will not make sense until you look back on them, especially with autism.
Okay.
When you get that retrospective.
Right. So are you thinking about creating a group? Do you know other individuals and other adults that have been diagnosed with autism that you can band with to create this group?
Not that I know of here in Georgia. A lot of my friends that I spend on time online with, a decent amount of them have different variations of autism on the spectrum. But here in Georgia, I'm not sure what I can do to get something like that going.
Virtual groups.
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard to establish something like that, especially in my case. Because, like, me personally, I do not really like kids. And so, I might have... Like, I get along great with kids, but I personally do not like them. I have the patience of Job. Like, that's the truth, but, like, it's really weird to weird it without not saying it like that.
Okay.
Because, like, I love my nephews, I love my cousins, but, like, kids in general. It's okay. Kind of hard being in public hearing screaming.
Okay.
The loud noises.
Okay.
Same thing for kids with autism. But, sorry.
No, it makes sense. It makes sense.
But, like, that's... Loud noises
mm-hmm.
is the main thing.
Overstimulation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Certain frequencies yeah. of that is what really gets it. That's probably one of the worst things for me.
So maybe it's not the kids. Maybe it's the behaviors and the sounds they make.
Not necessarily I guess you can call screaming a behavior, but it's mostly the frequency. It yeah. just gets something hurting in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like trying to get something going so adults with autism could at least give them something to either look forward to or give them more ways to figure out how to deal with a bad episode or just general advice
mm-hmm.
from personal experience would be the best way to help younger people with autism.
You can start with preteen. Might be a little better.
Because my thing is Advantage, that mm-hmm. place I was talking about, they don't have any dedicated adult services. So mm-hmm. I could try to bring it up with them to see if they could try to set something like that up. But mm-hmm. they don't primarily deal with autism.
Yeah, it might be something you can partner with them on and get that going.
It's kind of weird how there's a lack of stuff for adults with autism.
Yeah. So do you believe that that needs to start, you know, right at 18?
There needs to be a transitionary period because, for example, Medicaid usually phases out around 18, meaning that you can't really get services anymore. I think the law changed a while back. I don't know if the age range went up a little bit or not, or if it's based more on your parents' insurance. But usually, Medicaid usually drops you at 18. Mm-hmm. So at that point, you can't really get anything unless mm-hmm. you're on your parents' insurance or something like that.
Okay.
And so there needs to be like a transitionary thing for services, if they are receiving services, to help them. Because they don't really teach you nowadays in school how to be a proper adult. They don't teach you how to do taxes much anymore. They don't do general skills things as much anymore. Most of that stuff is elective, and it's more based on just test taking, not practicality.
So do you believe that your call to action would be geared mostly toward teachers, the state, and the resources available there, or people in the community?
It'd have to be all the above. Awareness is one thing, but if you don't do anything to help or try to help others with that, because there is a distinct lack that I have seen of general help for certain types of mental illnesses. There's not as much that I have seen when it comes to outside of places like Advantage. There's just not that much that I have seen when it comes to trying to actually help people.
Okay.
I don't know what's on the west side of the state or the south side of the state. I just know what's up in that area.
Okay. Now, with mental health, it seems to be more of a buzzword, right? You know, many people hear mental health and they shy away from it. They shy away from receiving help that they need. What would you say to those people?
Give it a shot, at least. If it's not for you, it's not for you. Because, like, therapy isn't for everybody. Mm-hmm. Medications are not for everybody. You could go through a laundry list of medications before you can find something that would help you personally. You'll have many different side effects from those medications that will make you go to a new one, and it's just rinse and repeat.
Mm-hmm.
So mostly just trying to figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm. So you spoke a lot about your biological family and your dad. Do you have any siblings?
One that I know for sure, my brother, my immediate brother. Almost exactly a year and a half older than me. So, what you want to know?
Okay, tell us about him. What was you guys' relationship like growing up?
Combative.
Yeah.
Very.
Like brothers do.
Yeah.
Do you believe that the nature of you guys' relationship was strained due to your diagnosis?
More than likely.
Yeah, how so?
The social cue stuff, like that stuff, really does a number on how we, as in the people with autism, typically interact even with our own family. Certain things being said, certain things being done, certain things being not said, not done, etc. And when it comes to family, that can get amplified really quickly because you're always together.
Mm-hmm.
And so certain things spill over a lot more than you'd think it would.
Yeah, for sure. And I know you mentioned that when you visited your family, you did notice that a second cousin was diagnosed with autism as well. Have you noticed anything in your brother or any other family members?
It seems like depression tends to run in our family for the most part. Bipolar in my case. I think it's major depressive disorder specifically for him. I don't know if it's that or it's one of those.
Mm-hmm. Now, you guys are just about a year and a half apart. So did you notice these things around the same time?
I mean, we've both shown evidence of our stuff mm-hmm. from an early age. Okay. I was the one in more active treatment compared to him, if I'm remembering correctly.
Okay.
It's not that he was anti-treatment. I think it was just like, because he was quote unquote more normal in public, it was a lot easier for him to adjust to everything compared to me. So I would have to talk to my adoptive mom more about it, about what her experience was between the both of us when it came to treatments.
Yeah.
The focus on treatments.
So in that sense, and not just with your brother, but, you know, you mentioned that on the high functioning level of autism, you know, and even as it relates to depression and the outward appearance of certain things, do you believe that you are or you were maybe treated a little differently in terms of your level of ability?
Definitely. And the, trying to think of the proper phrase, it's like the, like a blanket term, but it's just like when it comes to treatments and stuff like that, or in schooling, like I don't even like the term special education to an extent because of that, because like there are people who are slow learners that don't have a mental illness, it's just they just have trouble learning. And there are people who have mental illnesses that don't struggle with learning. So it's a weird fine line when it comes into that specific phrase, special education.
But they kind of lump everyone all together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I was saying earlier about Rutland, it's the, from my personal experience, there weren't that many people there with mental illnesses. It was just kids who were disruptive. And it was a school that was more prepared to deal with physical altercation than a typical school.
Yeah.
So they were, they had, I want to call it a lockdown room, but it's like they can put you in a small room that gets magnetically closed, meaning that there is no way out if they really need to get you in there. So it's like trying to deal with physical altercations and straight mental illness. And I don't fully appreciate people with mental illnesses automatically going either to schools like that or into special education. Having an IEP is not the same thing as special education because it can go both ways. With an IEP, you don't have to go into a special education dedicated class because no two students learn the same way to begin with. So you can't blanket everything with a specific group of students when it comes to special education. Some don't learn as fast. Some learn using only specific ways, meaning that you would have to have more extra specialized teachers to deal with different subsets instead of a whole classroom full of them.
Yeah.
I just feel like it feels disrespectful, in my opinion, to have that kind of setup.
Yeah. I understand.
When you look back on it, in my case, when I look back on it, it just seems disrespectful.
I get that. I remember when I was in junior high, we had regular ed gifted classes and then an inclusion class. But in the inclusion class, you had a variety of individuals and mostly individuals with behavioral issues. And then you had developmentally delayed and they were all in the same classrooms. And I think, you know, one of the issues that we had then that we also have now is the lack of teachers or the lack of, you know, resources in the schools, which is why they likely do that. What do you think?
There are a lot of teachers who care, but there's not a lot of specialists. There are teachers who would rather go by curriculum only and not try to deal with specific students, or they try to get them out of the class somewhere else instead of, it can't even be like a multi-tier in the same class. It's really hard to do because there are some schools that have, even if you have a, like a two teacher setup, it's still going to be a similar problem.
Yeah. Do you believe teachers,
under-equipped for one for that stuff?
Yeah. They lack that training.
That's not even always a lack of training, too. It's just lack of resources more than training.
Okay.
In some places. Because, like, there's already a lack of teachers. And when you have a lack of teachers, that means a lack of specialists, people who specialize with certain things. Mm-hmm. Either they go into private practice or they go to private schools instead, or they just quit altogether. I don't really know, but that seems to be what generally goes on.
That was your experience?
From what I've heard.
Okay.
Because I've had some good teachers. I've had some good principals. Mm-hmm. But the elementary school I was at, we had a dedicated special education classroom for, I think, each grade. It was by grade. And since I was the more disruptive type, instead of being developmentally delayed or I didn't really have that many problems learning. I love to learn, mm-hmm. but it has to be at my pace. And most teachers don't usually get that, even with quote unquote normal students. Not everybody learns at the same rate. Mm-hmm. And even if they do, it's just better to just give them the thing, let them do it, and work on others who might actually need help.
Yeah.
You don't need to. You don't need to talk down. You don't need to single out. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways to go about it, but it's really hard to do that when there's so few teachers, so few people who have been trained to work with different types of students when it comes to that. Because you can have a class full of fully disruptive kids, but if that teacher wasn't trained to deal with disruptive students, and they're more trained to deal with students who just have a harder time of learning, it's not the same thing. And that's just a bad situation all around.
Yeah. Have you noticed any difference, or have you had the opportunity to see what the education system is like now versus when you were in grade school?
I mean, things have been going towards the right direction. Because my elementary school, we actually had that class, even though it was just for each grade or something like that. I've been with the same people, Advantage, pretty much since after I was adopted, because they figured I had something. My adoptive mom, she figured I had something, but it wasn't just the bipolar early on. It wasn't just ADHD. And many years later, many problems later, many misunderstandings later, like the same things that got me into Laurelwood those four times, that when I went to Laurelwood, and I know I'm probably misremembering this, but I remember talking about a World War I documentary with my friends at the time for one of these occasions. And I was talking about how sometimes they had to make homemade, quote unquote, grenades while out in the field when they were running low or something like that. And I guess the teachers took it as me making a terroristic threat, which is a problem when they hear only a snippet of a conversation, because this was at Rutland. So in a school like that, their immediate thoughts is terroristic threat mode, not just kids talking about something they saw. Mm-hmm. And so that put me in Laurelwood for one of those times. And it's just like a similar thing for each one. I can't remember what caused each one, but it was like something I said, either taken out of context or I actually said something bad. I'm pretty sure at least one of those was a combination. But it was always something like that that got me there. And that's in that first or second stay at Laurelwood got me the diagnosis, because I didn't understand why I was even there. Mm-hmm. I was just talking to my friends and they're just like police escort or ambulance. I can't remember which one it was, but I went to Laurelwood for that, for one of them.
Yeah, I worked in a behavioral health hospital back in Delaware, and we had several students come in because they might say something just along the lines of that, or, you know, I don't want to be here anymore. And that's taken as something else, whether they meant it that way or not. But the idea is that when you're a mandated reporter, you hear anything, you have to take it seriously, right? And make sure this person is okay. How long were those visits each time?
I think they were about 2 weeks each.
Okay.
something like that. It was the equivalent of like a month and a half, 2 months of total time.
Okay. Did you go back to back?
No, there was a little gap in between each one.
Okay.
But it was in the same year. Actually, that reminds me of something. Group homes.
Yeah.
There's a place here in Atlanta called Hillside. I don't know if y'all have heard of it here in the studio. But Hillside, it's a... I qualified it as a group home, but it's more like a facility for kids with mental illnesses and certain behavioral things. And I was there from late 2007 till early 2010. Part of it is treatment oriented.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, not extreme schedules, but like set schedules. If you're on medication, you take it. All sorts of different things, but it's like I said, it's kind of like a group home, but more like a treatment facility kind of thing, but not like a hospital.
Do you feel like that helped you?
Yes and no. It definitely shaped me into who I am now. But things like that do help people, and for others, it won't.
How did it shape you?
I know that I've had my fair share of problems there too.
Mm-hmm.
I always look back on this weirdly, but one of the counselors, I ran away from that place a lot.
Mm.
I remember one time I went, because it's not that far from 85, the exit to 85, because it's right near Piedmont Park.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty close. And I remembered our path home. I had that memorized. I've had home visits, quote unquote, quite often. That's usually a reward for good behavior. And after a while, when they consider you not necessarily treated, but like more adjusted, you can be discharged and actually go home. I've ruined that a lot of times.
Hmm.
But one of those such occasions when I ran away, it was raining that night. Can't remember when in the year. I just remember it was raining one of those years. And I made it about 15-ish miles away. And I went down 85 to some extent. I don't know what exit I got off of, but there is a VFW down the way. And I ended up there after a while trying to dry off. And I was on the local news.
Wow.
I ask people on occasion if they remember hearing about a kid being found at a VFW during that time. Most people don't remember at all.
How old were you?
Let's see, 2007. I was born in 94. I can't math.
You say you were born in 94?
Yeah.
Okay, 13?
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Between 13 and 15.
Okay.
And that was one such occasion. And there was another occasion where I flipped the breaker that powered the electricity to the building when on my way out, meaning that they couldn't magnetically lock anything. I was very disruptive there.
What parts of it do you believe didn't quite help you?
Before I go to that, it definitely helped me adjust.
Okay.
Better to adjust to certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I didn't change, there was no way I could get out.
Okay.
Same could be said for a lot of things. But one of the things that it didn't for me is... that was shortly before or around the time I had the autism diagnosis. So, like, I'm still coming to terms with that even being a thing at that point. And things still weren't making sense because it wasn't talked about there, so I don't think they ever dealt with that. And there were no resources, so I never looked into it. And so things made sense when I looked back on them at that point. But, like, I'm trying to think of specifics now.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the counselors, the other individuals that were there with you.
And it wasn't even really misunderstandings or anything like that. I just didn't want to be there.
Mm.
And that's my main thing. If I didn't want to be there, I would try to do everything in my power to get away from it.
Mm. Do you believe it helped you socially, being around other individuals that, you know, you guys shared similarities?
Probably. I remember two of my therapists there. One who's, I don't know if it was his first name or last name, but it was, I just called him Mr. Dean. He was one of my favorite people there. And the other person, I know her full name. She was a family therapist, and she moved to Warner Robins at some point after mm-hmm. she left there. Her name was Robin Havanek. She was another great person. I always got along with her.
Okay. Do you believe that being away from home in that aspect, although you were still finding and redefining, you know, yourself, that you learned a level of independence and maturity?
I believe so. I don't know how much, but I know I did.
Well, I'd like to thank you for being with us today and sharing your experience, sharing, you know, your heart to our listeners. And we always hope that the stories that you share can help our listeners get through rough times, let them know that they are not the only ones going through it, and push them to seek community. So thank you, Keith, for being on our show today. We appreciate you. We loved having you.
Thank you for having me.